speaker's bio tonight. During the 10th months leading up to the American Civil War, the cadets at the United States Military Academy at West Point continued their education even as the nation threatened to dissolve around them. Students from both the North and South struggled to understand these events. Our lecture tonight features our speaker and fellow roundtable member, Mr. Brian McEnany, who will be following the cadets from their initiation through coursework to the battlefield and focusing on the 12 Union and 4 Confederate soldiers. Brian graduated from the United States Military Academy in the class of 1962 and serves in artillery assignments in Germany, Korea, and the United States, and then also in combat in Vietnam. A retired Lieutenant Colonel and Operations Research Analyst, he is the author of several historical articles about West Point during the Civil War. He serves on our executive committee, and he lives in Vienna, Virginia, with his lovely wife, Lilith, in the back. Welcome, Mr. Brian McEnany.
That's fine. Thanks, Mark. Let me make sure that you got this thing working. Got it. Thanks, Mark, for that kind introduction. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you. This is the third time that I've talked about West Point to this particular group. First back in 2006, and then 2011, I came out and talked at Mike Block's at Brandy Station Formation the same. But first of all, how many West Point graduates do we have here this evening? Oh, wonderful. I just needed to find out how many lies I can tell before about the academy before I get caught. I am wearing a blue uniform this evening to make a point, and that is, with all due deference to Don Hackinson and people, there are Yankees in the crowd that do not cheer when Mosby and Stewart's name are crawled out. And for those of you who only come in May, I am not Ed Barrs. When I talk about West Point, I often get asked why I am interested in this particular class. And initially it was because this class graduated 100 years before my own class. And I have a personal connection. My great-great-grandfather was a sergeant in the engineer company at West Point during this period of time and helped train some of the cadets in here. So I started digging into the musty old cadet records up there in the archives at West Point, and I discovered stories about what I believe to be an extraordinary group of young men. More research and at the National Archives and a few other places, and I discovered that there weren't any books, very many books, about an individual class. There's lots of books and stories and articles and movies about West Point and its more famous graduates. When you talk about a total class, John Wall wrote a book about the class of 1846, which was McClellan and Jackson. Ralph Kirschner wrote a book about 1861. Mary Elizabeth Sargent wrote two books, one about the May class and one about the June class of 1861, and that's it. The classes of 62, 63, 64, and 65, they're except for individual articles by one or two people in those areas, there are no books about those classes. So I sort of took it as a task to go through and write a history of this particular class. And now, 12 years later, I have a book out that was published the 7th of April by the University Press of Kentucky that we have in the back of the room there. So I think that I'm getting my task just about finished at the time. But let me pick up here. Sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. This particular picture has five members of the class in it. Bill Murray, Ronald McKenzie, Albert, Jim Sanderson, and Bill Bartlett. The other ones were part of the company that was there. And I found this at the Military History Institute. And it is in George Meade Jr.'s photographic album. And this is George Meade Jr. Now, he was there for about a year plus and flunked out, basically. Went back, joined the Pennsylvania Cavalry, and became his father's aide at one time. That's the start point of these, and I'll talk about some of these as we go along. The main character in my book, of which I portray every once in a while in terms of living history, is Telly McRae. Telly was a Southerner by birth. He was born in Natchez, Mississippi, and in 1838, but he was orphaned when he was 13 years of age. And he was sent north with his brother to live with his northern relatives in Ohio. And then 5 years later was appointed to West Point from Ohio. By that time, he had sort of picked up more northern views, much to the distaste of his relatives down in Natchez, Mississippi by that time. Telly, if you recognize his name, you probably recognize the young lady on the right. Her name is Belle. There was a book written called Dear Belle about 45 to 50 years ago by Elizabeth Crary that talked about Tully's letters. Tully was a prolific letter writer. There's 250 of his letters in the archives at West Point. I've read them all. He is very descriptive of the time when he was a cadet all the way through his time at the Civil War, and he wrote to that young lady. Now, Tully was wounded during the war fairly severely. After he got out of the hospital, he came back to be a professor at West Point. And I've sort of used that context in the book and used his memories to start each of the chapters that I have in the book. Telly is a major. It was in the officer's mess at West Point. And this is Brigadier General Telly McRae in 1903 at Gettysburg, leaning on the gun that he fired at Ziegler's Grove at Gettysburg, and I'll tell you a little story about that as we go through. Telly and his classmates came to West Point at a period of time when the United States consisted of just 32 states, half free, half slaves, and six territories, about 31 million, most of them east of the Mississippi River in this part of the country. The president was James Buchanan. The aging Winfield Scott ran the army. The Secretary of War was John B. Floyd from Virginia. And, the Union Army was only 17,000 strong, relatively small. It was scattered around the coast. It was scattered across the country. And to protect the colonists the settlers that were moving west for the most part. At West Point, the superintendent was Brevet Colonel Richard Delafield. He was on his second tour there. And he supervised about 450 to 500 military, not counting the families and things that were in that particular area. He supervised the academic staff, the artillery battery, the engineer company, the West Point band, the tactical department, and the United States Corps of Cadets. Now, the commandant, William J. Hardee, who, of course, within a year and a half, would resign his commission to become a Confederate general and a corps commander in the Army of the Tennessee. Now, the other thing that you might recognize is that several of the instructors that were there in this period of time, between 1858 and 1862, I'm sure you recognize their names. Gouverneur Warren, Oliver Howard, first lieutenants, were taught mathematics to Telly McRae and his classmates. E.P. Alexander, Longstreet's chief of artillery, was teaching there. And Fitzhugh Lee was a tactical officer towards the last part of the thing. So many of the instructors that had gone through here later commanded these cadets on both sides as they went through the war. Now, United States Corps of Cadets, it was 275 strong. It was controlled by the number of appointments that the congressman was allowed to have. And it was organized as an infantry battalion, four companies. It was arranged by height. A Company and D Company were the tall cadets. B Company and C Company were the shorter cadets. I just came back from giving a lecture down in the Northern Neck, and I was told, and I'm still need to find out, so it's an anecdotal story at this point, that the reason they did the height was there was a hump in the middle of the plain, and they put the shorter cadets in there and the taller cadets there so there would be a straight line across when you saw the plain. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm going to try to chase it down. But at this point, West Point was the premier engineering school in the country. The fathers eagerly sought appointments for their sons, and their sons were taught by world-class professors whose textbooks and were being used in many of the universities and colleges around the country. So Telly and 83 other candidates arrived in June of 1858. And they came to in here to go through the entrance exams, which were a medical exam and an academic exam. They gave them about 3 weeks to be there because it took a long time for people to move around the country this time. There was no transcontinental rail. I mean, if you wanted to get to San Francisco, you had to take a clipper ship, and it was 90 days was the shortest that you could get there. So wagon trains were not out of here. But anyway, they gave them 3 weeks to get there in June. Their ages range from 16 to 21 years of age. The medical exam was basically check their teeth, check their bones for deformity. They would put a coin on the wall at 15 paces, and they would test to see whether or not it was heads or tails. If they could make that differentiation, then they'd pass the eye test. The academic test, a little bit better, but it was still very simple. Now, this is a picture here in the old library, and the academic board, the superintendent, the commandant, and the senior professors individually interrogated the new candidates. They asked them questions, basically, to demonstrate, add, subtract, multiply, and divide, work with fractions. They asked them to read a passage from a book. They had their writing checked, and they had their spelling checked. Fairly simple. Congress required it to be simple in this time frame. Over the objections of the people on the academic board, but that's the way they wanted to have it done. Now, even as simple as that sounds, only 66 of the 84 made it through to be new cadets. They enter in class in 1858. Now, here's some of them that were in that class. Excuse me. Ranald McKenzie, first in the class. George Gillespie, the only Southerner that stayed with the class. He graduated second of class, Morris Shaft, and John Califf, and I'll talk little stories about them as we go along. The entering class wasn't complete because the official records say on the 1st of July there were 66. There was actually 9 more that joined the class before academics started. 7 were appointed by congressmen to replace those that had failed in an exam. They passed their own exams and they came in without going through the summer camp type of thing. And then 2 were what they call turnbacks. Turnbacks were someone who had failed a course the year before and had been required to go through and redo the whole year. So 75 members of this class, and I'll track the numbers down here as we go along, that's the size of the class in 1858 that they started. Now, let me show you a couple of historic pictures of the Military Academy. And you know, as a cadet, we always laugh about West Point being sort of over 200 years unhampered by progress. And when I was a cadet, a lot of these buildings were still there. But this particular picture was taken from where the post chapel is right now, up on the hill. Here's a picture of the map of West Point at that time. This is the plain. Summer camp was conducted out here. The West Point Hotel stands where Battle Monument is today. This is the post headquarters. The old chapel sits here. The old chapel still exists. It's now in the post cemetery. It was torn down from its current from then. Gwen has been there. Janet has been up there to take some pictures of some of the generals' memorials that are there. And there's a picture of the post and library and the chapel. Now, the cadets lived in barracks. Now, barracks in this period of time were relatively new. They're about 5 or 6 years. Tully was in A Company, and he was down in the 2nd Division, which is right in here. There are 4 rooms in each floor, 4 floors. This was part of what I remember as old Central Area. It was a quadrangle when I was there. This is only an L-shaped building. So in the first 2 divisions were A Company. In the 2nd divisions were B Company. This is a tunnel or a sally port through the barracks. This is C Company. And they actually had bachelor officers living in the 7th and 8th Division at this period of time. And then D Company was down here. Now, if you were a Southerner, there was a high probability you might have been assigned to D and C Companies for some reason. The adjutants would put them in there. Not a hard, fast rule, but there were more Southerners that would end up in here. Example, Custer was in D Company, but Custer roomed with a Southerner. Tully from Ohio roomed with a Southerner, George Gillespie, down in the other company. So they had it. Now, these are 2 pictures or sketches made by a cadet at that period of time that showed what the barracks rooms looked like. Fairly bare. they had deficiencies in the barracks. And the deficiencies, first of all, were the heat didn't come up very well during the wintertime from the coal-fired furnaces in the basement. There were letters that talk about the cadets having to study with blankets wrapped around them or with overcoats in order to stay warm. Sometimes their water buckets had ice in them when they woke up in the morning, because that was the other problem. There's no running water in the barracks. The plebes task, the first year gentlemen, they went out in the morning and got the upper class buckets, filled them up, sent them back, and then they had to go back to get their own. Now, they would go to the mess halls, and excuse me, this is the mess hall up here. It's on the state. It's Grant Hall sitting on the site right now, and they sat at these long tables. That's what the inside of the mess hall looked like. One part down here was the officers' mess, and the rest of it was the cadet mess. Well, cadet life was very disciplined, probably dull and boring at this particular time. It started at 5 o'clock in the morning at Reveille. A short time after that, they were eating in the mess hall. Meals were pretty short. They're only about 30 minutes long. The classes, they went to class 5.5 days a week. First year plebes, mathematic classes and were an hour and a half long in the mornings, an hour in the afternoon. Every day they had drills or parades, usually from 4:30 until sunset and then supper. And they had a closed study period from 7:30 at night to 9:30 in the evenings. And at 10 o'clock, lights out, everybody in bed. Pretty disciplined set of setup. This is where they took their classes, down here in the academy. It was set on the corner in between the barracks and the old chapel. During the summertime, they took them out of barracks and they took them to where I put on the map where the summer camp was. It's on the plain, and they were in tents. Lived the life of the soldier from after graduation in June until end of August, when the cadets would all come back. And they marched every place. They marched to class, all of them marched to class, every class formations. They marched to chapel. Chapel was mandatory on Sundays. And they marched to meals 3 times a day. And this part down here was very disciplined, dull, and monotonous. And I will tell you that began to change. And it started changing between John Brown's raid in October 1859 and the summer of 1860. Now, John Brown raid had an impact on West Point. I wrote an article about this in one of the Association of Graduate magazines that had in there. Not only was Robert E. Lee a former superintendent that led the relief column, and he had a second lieutenant by the name of Jeb Stuart that went along with him, but when John Brown went in, he took hostages. And one of the hostages was a gentleman by the name of Washington. His son was in D Company at West Point. So there was a lot of interest in what took place there. John Brown, of course, was tried in a Virginia court and hung. And at that point, the South began to realize that there was a major difference of opinion over popular sovereignty and slavery and the way of life in the South versus what the abolitionist side of the House built in the North. The North pealed church bells and they fired cannons when John Brown was hung to tell everyone that he was a martyr. By the summer of 1860, Tully had been there for pretty close to 2 years. That was the first time he was allowed to leave West Point. Now, in this 2 year period of time, they lost 25 of their classmates. Academic failures, mostly in the mathematics department. So they're down to 50 in their class at the summer of 1860. When they went home, they were thrust in the middle of the political campaigns that were underway. This was the summer of presidential campaigns. Abraham Lincoln was the nominee for the Republican Party. The Democratic Party was split in two, John Breckinridge for the South and Stephen Douglas for the North. The issue was popular sovereignty and extended into the territories. There was a third party, a Constitution Party, of John Bell that took place. So when the cadets came back, what they brought with them was all of the biases and prejudices that they may have about the political campaigns between the North and the South. This generated, obviously, tensions at the academy. Southern voices began to talk about things like disunion. Some of the Southern cadets vowed that they would not support Lincoln. Actually, some of the South Carolinians wrote a letter to the Columbia Guardian, and they told them that if Lincoln was elected, that they would not serve under him as commander-in-chief. In the class of 1862 was a red-headed firebrand by the name of Henry S. Farley. Henry S. Farley, according to Bud Hall, is the brother of Will Farley, who was Stuart's chief scout. Henry S. Farley was from South Carolina. He said, if Lincoln is elected, I will resign. So this is what you had coming into out of the summer of 1860 that was put in there. They actually went through a straw poll, and you can go up on the internet and find the results on that. Breckinridge won, because not only was the Southerners felt he was better, his running mate had a son at West Point, a D Company at that time. Well, in November, of course, Abraham Lincoln was elected, and the first cadet to resign was Henry S. Farley at the outset of the war. And of course, you know what happened after that. South Carolina started the process of secession in December, and in January and February, six more states seceded, and the Confederacy was formed. By the end of March, what you had was the cotton states were calling for the cadets to come back. And it wasn't all the politicians that had appointed them were calling the cadets. Even the governors were giving them conflicting devices. South Carolina cadets, no question about it. Georgia, come home. Virginia, stay and graduate. If we need you, we will call for you. They got a lot of pressure on the Southern cadets from their families, from their friends, and from other cadets from the same state. Tully was getting letters from his relatives in Mississippi. His sister wanted to know why he hadn't resigned and come home when Mississippi seceded. Tully said that basically he did not believe in what the South was doing at that time and was espousing Northern views. His aunt wrote him and said, I would rather see you in your grave than tell me that again. So the type of pressures that were coming in there, they were faced with making hard choices. And the choices were stay and abide by my oath to support the Union, or return, protect my family and state, and potentially have to join a Confederate army, which may have me fight against my classmates. Well, the other thing that they saw at this particular time is that the leadership at the military academy turned over three times. PGT Beauregard came in for 1 week and was replaced by Delafield again, simply because he made a statement in Washington that if Louisiana seceded, he was going to leave. So that took place in January. Delafield was replaced by Alexander Bowman before the end of March. Hardee leaves. John Reynolds comes in to be the commandant at West Point for a period of time, and then he leaves to rejoin his regiment. Half the instructors left, either through resignation or to return to their regiment. So you can see that the cadets were getting a lot of conflicting views at this particular point. Well, come the 12th of April at 4:30 in the morning, Fort Sumter was bombarded. Now, and a lot of people tell you who fired the first shot. I will tell you that Henry S. Farley fired the signal mortar to start the bombardment. And at the sesquicentennial, his great-great-grandson fired the mortar down in Charleston Harbor in 2011. In April and May, of course, Virginia, the legislature went to secede, and they were rapidly brought by three other states. So now you have 11 states that have formed the Confederacy. And one thing I did want to mention is that when I talk about Southerners, I am only talking about the cadets that came from the 11 states that formed the Confederacy. So we get that straight. Now, the Oath of Allegiance changed a little bit to make it much more specific to the changes in what they were doing with the states. And in the upper classes, the two upper classes, petitioned the Secretary of War to graduate early. And he agreed with them. So in May 6th, they have a May class of 1861. This is Kirby and Upton and Kilpatrick's class that graduated at that particular time. 45 days later, Custer's class graduated. Tully McRae started out as a third classman, and in 45 days has been catapulted to lead the Corps, is now a first classman. His class was also thought to graduate early, but the Secretary of War changed his mind and said, we're going to keep you here for a year. Now, between Lincoln's election and the end of the summer of 1861, the class of 1862 lost half its members. It had lost 19 dead out here, and it's down to about 30 members that are left. Now, that was internal to West Point. External to West Point, look at what was happening. The new administration, Simon Cameron, is making statements in the annual statement about West Point not training the cadets to know the difference between right and wrong. Abraham Lincoln is castigating the Army for the loss of officers that we're setting in here. And the radical Republicans, Wade and Chandler, made serious arguments against the military. They were going back almost to Jacksonian arguments that would said the volunteers ought to be able to do it. And as you, in 1862, in the early part of 1863, the battlefield performance of the Union Army wasn't that great. So he had a thing. They actually tried to abolish the military in January, the military academy in January of 1863. Didn't get enough votes to be able to do it, but they did try. But it was very clear that West Point had lost the respect of the government, of the country. On June the 17th of 1862, the members of the class of 1862 graduated. And by this time, they had 28 members left. They lost four more to academics in that final year. And what I wanted to point out is their assignments. Initial assignments they were told that they were going to are shown off on the side here. Now, the ones in red are the ones that I wrote stories about in the Civil War section of my book. And I wanted to make sure that there were some human interest that was in there. There's too many books about generals and strategy and whatnot. So I picked 12 of the Union graduates to run stories through. And the chapters show the intermingling of them at various battles, and also I picked up four of their ex-classmates, Deering, Blount, Semmes, and West, because they did interact during the war and at some points, whether they knowingly were firing at one another or whether they actually knew that happened. Well, I was able to track about 21 of the Confederates down. Not as much detail as I have for the actual graduates, but from the Confederate records I could pick up where they went. And as I was looking down this list, I looked at John Blocker, and I suddenly remembered that at the beginning of the war, he was captured. And he was captured at Roanoke Island. And it reminded me of a anecdotal story I heard about the exchange of prisoners. And it was a Confederate, a Southern lady, who basically was told that her husband was going to be exchanged. And she was highly incensed about that. She said she would never have a Yankee husband, and that's that. Well, during the Civil War, the members of the class, basically they started out with McClellan's army at Harrison's Landing. 21 out of the 28 ended up in the Army of the Potomac. The others, partial of them, had to stay at West Point for instructions, and others went to staff on the East and West. A few of them fought with Pope, and some of them at Second Bull Run, a few with Banks in the Valley, but the rest of them were pretty much down at Harrison's Landing in July of 1862. Now, the ones I haven't read there are part of the chapters that I have, and the stories that I have of these members of the class are really stories of junior officers and how they struggled and fought during the war in these campaigns. So my chapters are not the Fredericksburg campaign, it's John Egan at the Fredericksburg, and it's Ranald McKenzie at Cedar Creek, and as I was telling the stories as we went along through there. Now, stories need context. I have 85 photographs in the pictures that I've got there, either from the Library of Congress or from sketches and from Harper's Weekly. I spent an hour over Ed Wenzel's house taking photos of the original Harper's Battles and Leaders, went then and down at the Virginia Room to do the same thing, and been able to clear the copyrights and whatnot to be able to show them. Now, in this particular picture, I got this up at the Military History Institute, there are three members of the class. This is Frank Hamilton, this is Charles Warner, and this is Sam McIntyre, all artillerymen. Charles Warner was the goat of the class. He finished last in the class. His great-great-grandson is a fellow by the name of James Lafferty, and he lives in Redlands, California. His daughter graduated military intelligence lieutenant in 2011 from West Point. There's a great-great-grandson that's set up there. I have included about 22 maps, and one of the points I was making earlier is my maps are not really tactical maps to show the battle. It's really to show the location of where the members of the class stood. This is McKenzie at Cedar Creek. He was part of the 6th Corps. How did he get there? He was an engineer. Well, there's stories that go along with this because he took over an infantry regiment after Cole Harbor and went with the 6th Corps to Petersburg, went to Washington, ended up working with Sheridan here in this area. And at this particular time, he was a regimental commander of the 2nd Connecticut Heavy Artillery, converted to infantry. After the early morning attack that took place, they all fell back, of course, and then formed the defensive line, and Sheridan's attack took place. During this period of time, McKenzie was wounded twice, once so severely that his arm was paralyzed. He had his sergeant put him up on a horse and take him forward. McKenzie was wounded 6 times during the war. He was brave to a fault, a very stern disciplinarian that had in there. But Grant called him the most promising officer because he ended up as a major general of cavalry. And I'll explain a little bit of that as we lead forward. Well, one of the members of the class, whose name I showed you earlier, picture showed you, is George Gillespie. George Gillespie was an engineer. And at Cole Harbor, at Bethesda, which was the battle before Cole Harbor, General Meade wanted to know when Sheridan's made contact down here at Old Cole Harbor, because they were a very important intersection for that they wanted to protect for future operations. And George Gillespie was up here with the 5th Corps with General Warren. He had participated with some of the interrogation of Southern prisoners that morning, and he sent orders back when he heard the cannon fire that said Sheridan was engaged. And then Gillespie decided to go find Sheridan himself. So what I tried to do was to say this is the dotted path that he probably followed to get down to Cole Harbor, but he took off on horseback, went across the swamp, ran into a Confederate picket, and because he's a Southerner, his accent let him get away by asking a question of where was Fitzhugh Lee's headquarters. The guy pointed him in the right direction, he took off, and then immediately cut back into the forest, came out in the middle of an infantry regiment this time, and got fired at, galloped away, and got to Sheridan's headquarters at about 7 o'clock that evening. Sheridan told him that he was leaving Cole Harbor, that he did not feel he was supported, and actually, at that point, Gillespie believed that this had to get back to General Meade as quickly as possible. He made his way back and arrived at Meade's tent at about 9 o'clock that night, and Meade immediately sent a message by orders back to Sheridan that's hold Cole Harbor at all costs. Sheridan had already left and was stretched out, turned the command around and went back and reoccupied the positions at Old Cole Harbor. The same thing that happened, General Meade immediately told the 6th Corps and the newly arrived 18th Corps to join Sheridan the next morning. Gillespie didn't get the Medal of Honor then. He didn't get the Medal of Honor until 36 years later. And he submitted the paperwork. But by that time, George Gillespie was a colonel in the Chief of Engineers office. What I've got a picture up here is in 1896, in here, this was what the Medal of Honor looked like. It was also very close to what the patriotic groups were putting out and as medals for their particular groups. And Gillespie believed that this was not right, that there should be a unique design. Gillespie as now became a brigadier general, became the chief of engineers, and set a committee up to redesign the Army's Medal of Honor. And this is the current design. That is Gillespie's medal. He owned the patent for that and has re-signed it to the Secretary of War in 1904 when Congress approved that particular design. So if you hear Gillespie medal, that's what they're talking about. This is the Army's design. Each one of the medals of honor for the services are all different. This is the exact citation that that they had that took in there. Well, last one I want to take a couple of stories about, some of the untold stories, had to do with Gettysburg. We were up there earlier last year for on McPherson's Ridge up here, where Buford's statue is. Well, you know the story about Buford holding back the Confederates on Chambersburg Park. Well, there's a picture here that Don Trione wrote. And if you look at the cover of Trione's book that deals with the cavalry and artillery, what you'll find is a picture that he has of Buford pointing to a second lieutenant who happens to be John Califf. And he's telling Califf to stretch his guns out along McPherson's Ridge so that they will believe that there's more artillery present than there actually was. And of course, for a two-hour period of time, the combination of Califf's guns and Buford's cavalrymen, he did hold back the Confederates until the First Corps arrived with John Reynolds. What you probably don't know is that when the First Division from the First Corps came on board, General Wadsworth put them in, the cavalry was allowed to pull back. The chief of artillery of the First Corps refused to send his artillery to McPherson's Ridge. He believed that they would be wasted away because of the guns who had now come from not only the Chambersburg Pike, but also from Oak Hill. And over Buford's violent objections, they sent John Califf's guns back up to the hill. Califf took four guns up there. He did suffer casualties, and he wrote later in life that the rounds from Oak Hill played merrily in between my limbers and teams on the reverse slope. But they were able to come back. He was only able to man five guns the next day as he came through. on the second day, you know all about Little Round Top and General Warren finding that it was not occupied by Union forces. Well, he had two aides with him that day. One of them was Ronald McKenzie, engineer staff for General Meade's Army of the Potomac. And Warren turned around and said, "Find me a regiment." He sent his raids out. McKenzie went down into the valley to see General Sickles. General Sickles then was in the midst of it with Longstreet's attack that afternoon, and he refused to give McKenzie any forces. McKenzie rode back up up to the top of Cemetery Ridge, and he runs into General Sykes, bringing the 5th Corps forward. And General Sykes said, "What do you need?" And he said, "We need a brigade or a regiment to occupy Little Round Top." And he grabbed his aide and he pointed off the 1st Brigade. This is Strong Vincent's brigade, and the 1st Regiment was the 20th Maine. And of course, you know the incident of that particular setup as you went through. On the third day, General Hunt, the chief of artillery, is coming back from Culp's Hill in mid-morning, and he sees a line of cannons coming into the valley between Seminary Ridge and Cemetery Ridge. This is E.P. Alexander lining up the first 75 guns from Longstreet's Corps to attack the Union Center. The far left side, if you're facing Cemetery Ridge, the far left is Major James Deering's battalion. He was the chief of artillery for Pickett's division. And in there was Joseph Blount's guns from the Lynchburg battery on the far left. Up on Cemetery Hill, on the far left, as you're looking at Cemetery Hill, which is the far right of the Union Center, at Ziegler's Grove, and Ziegler's Grove is where the old visitor center used to be. The grove of trees right behind the parking area there were the old visitor centers, is George Woodward's battery of artillery. It's the right of the Union line, if you will. And the two section leaders are Tully McRae and John Egan. The first sergeant has got the third section that sits in there. They were able to sustain themselves during the bombardment, but at the end, Tully McRae and John Egan are the only two regulars that were still standing. All the other officers, both volunteers and regulars, that were in the area that was bombarded were either killed or wounded. Now, at the end of the lines that were coming across, they could see the three lines forming. And Tully McRae was interviewed in 1903 up at Gettysburg, and what he wrote down was, he said when he saw those three lines of gray, he thought his chances of getting to Libby prison or Kingdom Come were pretty good. When the lines, of course, got up to the angle, that's where Cushing's battery was. Cushing's battery was virtually destroyed on their side. General Hayes came into Woodward and said, I need some help. Egan took two guns, moved to the angle, and at the last minute was there to help restore that particular area. General Meade comes up alongside of him and he says, Egan, have they turned? And this was at the point where Pickett's men and the North Carolinians began to move back across the valley. And Egan told him, yes, sir, they have. And at that point, the cheers began to go up as they realized that the Confederates had been beaten back. Well, let me get to the last slide I have here that talks about this. And the stories in my book sort of cover the period from 1858 to 1865, but I do have biographical sketches for each member of the class throughout their careers and whatnot. Now, four of the eight that I've talked about, these are basically obituary pictures I've been able to find, is here's John Califf, a colonel. This is Morris Shaft. He was a brigadier general in the Connecticut militia. Major General George Gillespie, Sam McIntyre, and Brigadier General Tully McRae, and Brigadier General in the Regular Army, Ranald McKenzie. Now, not covered in my book, but McKenzie has five books written about him because he became quite an Indian fighter after the war. This is the McKenzie who chased the Apaches back across the Rio Grande and created quite a foreign policy for Grant and whatnot in there. He commanded the 4th Cavalry in Texas after the war. Grant's most promising officer that he had in there. Unfortunately, he died at age 49, a combination of six wounds during the Civil War plus one from an Indian, and he had lost two fingers of his hand to a sniper at Petersburg. The Indians called him Bad Hand. So there's a couple of books that talk about that. Well, it's very difficult to evaluate the worth of an entire class. And I know that for Southerners, perhaps General Lee's words that were in his final order might be enough. You will take with you the satisfaction that proceeds from the consciousness of duty faithfully performed. And perhaps that's all that a Southerner needed to put a piece of paper in his backpack as he was paroled and go back to his home. But for a class like this, I thought perhaps much more were needed. It's very easy to count the number of generals and count the awards. And it's not only for this class, but for any class. And I have included an assessment in my book of what I felt was the worth of this particular thing. And I would hope that the readers would agree with me. Based on official reports, the members of this class had trained their men into formidable soldiers, and they inspired them by acts of bravery. 24 of the 28 were breveted for gallantry. Tully was breveted 3 times for gallantry. McKenzie 7 times for gallantry. By the end of the war, several of them have commanded volunteer units, just 4, and one and a cavalry division, which was McKenzie. And a few were required to take command under very trying combat conditions as lieutenants, as junior officers. And unfortunately, they lost those commands within a few months because of more senior officers coming in to take over. Many were wounded within the class, and only 4 were lost to disease. One was captured, and the others were killed in battle. For those who remained in the service for 40 years, 8 of them would become general officers. 4 here plus 4 others that well, you can raise questions about what was the impact of the slowness of promotions, you know, for the regulars during a particular war, and why did this class not transfer more into the volunteers? and as they said in there. And I provided some answers in the assessment section of my book. But on balance, I think of this particular group of young men, that the members of the class of 62 truly measured up to the motto of the military academy, which was duty, honor, and country. Now, Telly McRae wrote when he was a cadet that his class would never come together again in a gathering, no reunions after they graduated. And there is a hymn that is sung the Sunday before graduation, and it's titled, "When Will We Meet Again?" And the refrain is, "Never, no, never," they would set in there. Well, I would like to think that my book has formed that particular gathering and reunion for the class of 1862. Well, I hope my talk has interested enough to read some of my stories and about what happened, other stories about what happened at West Point that caused half this class to resign, and how junior officers struggled and fought to preserve the country and help West Point regain its respect. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate it, and I'd be happy to answer your questions. Nancy.
Yeah, it's very interesting and intriguing to find out that George Gillespie, a Southerner, decided to stay in West Point. He must have had family pressures to opt out.
He came from Eastern Tennessee, or from Western Tennessee, which was a Union area.
Okay.
He promised his father that he would stay with the Union. When Tennessee seceded, he did get letters to come and say, we'll give you a regiment in the Confederate Army, and he turned them down. He also turned down the same thing from the Union forces that were there when Tennessee was occupied during the war. He was kept at West Point for about 6 months after the war, and then partially because they didn't want him, he thought that he didn't want him to go back and fight against any of his family and friends, but then he ended up as an engineer in the Army of the Potomac. Ultimately, at the end of the war, he was Sheridan's chief engineer. If you go into the maps, the official atlas, look for Sheridan's maps, you'll find George Gillespie, who was the parts of the cartographer, the chief engineer for Sheridan. Sir.
How does 8 generals from a class compare to other normal West Point classes?
Low
or high? Or?
I don't know. I had 603 that graduated in my class.
603?
603.
Yeah.
We had, I think, about 20 generals that came out of my class. Mm-hmm. One was the chief of staff of the Army. One was the commander of Special Operations Command, and some assorted lieutenant generals and brigadiers that were tucked in there. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. I think the general thought is that the first in the class doesn't automatically become a general. It's those that are sort of in the middle of the class with a certain extent that took place. So I don't think there's any way that you can say just because you're in this part of the class that you're automatically going to be a general. A lot of them, in this case, I will tell you that McKenzie and Bill Bartlett and two of the others, they got commands because they were in the right place at the right time on the battlefield. Either their general turned around and said, I need somebody to replace them. What do you think? And they got the command. McKenzie took over the 2nd Connecticut because the 2nd Connecticut had been severely messed up, lost a lot of casualties, and its second in command refused to take command, the volunteers. And the guy, they were in Upton's brigade, and Upton remembered that McKenzie had helped him out at Spotsylvania, and he recommended that McKenzie take over. The members of the regiment said yes, and the state of Connecticut said yes. Grant said yes, and Meade said yes. So on the 10th of June, Colonel Ronald McKenzie, U.S. Volunteers, comes in and takes over the regiment. So it's that type of thing that happens.
May I have your attention, please? The library will close in 30 minutes at 9 o'clock. If you need to make arrangements for a ride home, please do so now. If you need to apply for a library card, please go to the information or check out desk now.
Sir.
Of the ones who went south, of course, giving up the West Point degree meant a tremendous sacrifice in the field of engineering. Did any of those subsequently become engineers? Or was that just the end of that
Not certain, because I don't know exactly. Henry Farley came north, became a teacher and professor in Mount Pleasant Academy across the river from West Point. Went out to Hollywood, became an actor for a period of time, and then went back to South Carolina and ended up as an editor of one of the big newspapers that were down there. Some of the others I didn't track in a lot of their, I didn't really get into the detail of that. James Deering, now Deering became a major general of cavalry. Deering was an artilleryman, but when the artillery battery and pickets division went to Petersburg, Rooney Lees asked for a composite commander, where they had North Carolina and Georgia cavalry put together, and he requested that Deering take over. And Deering took over that until almost the end of the war, and then he was transferred into Tom Rosser's division and became the commander of the Laurel Brigade, and was mortally wounded at High Bridge, during Lee's retreat. He goes back to the hospital in Lynchburg, and Mackenzie, you saw the Appomattox surrender. Okay, it didn't all happen on one day. The infantry happened on one day. The artillery happened on another day. Rinald Mackenzie was ordered to take command of, or take the surrender of the Confederate cavalry. And he did that, and then was ordered to Lynchburg to take the surrender of the town. He finds Deering in the hospital, makes sure he gets the parole, and puts guards on there to protect him as they're going through the city. He wasn't there when Deering passed away on the 24th of April, the last Confederate general to die of combat wounds.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sir, Don, Ron.
Yeah. Brian, as I understand it, the West Point graduates in that time, the top graduates became engineers, then artillery, then infantry.
Yet all of these ordnance students.
Okay.
Yeah.
But these all seem to go directly into combat units.
Not all of them. The engineer staffs put them out. Several of them went out to the Army of the Cumberland. The staff out in the West. There were ordnance assignments to arsenals, and Morris Shaft was an ordnance officer. It was his ordnance company that went up at City Point. They thought that his men had done that, and he was transferred out and went up to Springfield Arsenal at the end of the war. And it wasn't until after the war that they found that it had been a Confederate saboteur. And they found that when they opened up Jeff Davis's office, the Confederate White House, they were going through the reports. And then the guy who built this tried to get a patent on it because it'd done a pretty good job at City Point. Sir?
Did any of the 1862 graduates end up out west during the Sioux uprisings and all that?
No, afterwards. Mackenzie was there.
Well, I know that, but there were uprisings going on in 1862. But was that mostly just volunteer troops out there, or
Minnesota,
D.C.?
Yeah.
Sir.
In June of 1861, a lot of the first cavalry in the West was brought back to the East.
Third cavalry was paroled and came back. One of the members of this class, Frank James, was assigned to that. Could not join that. And was assigned the 1st Cavalry with the Army of the Potomac until the parole to left over.
A regiment of Kansas Volunteer Cavalry was sent out by company to the Western Forest to replace them.
Yeah.
In 1861.
The other questions?
Would you know who was the superintendent of West Point in 1862?
Alexander Bowman. And he was within a couple of days. Can't remember his name. I'll think of it. The guy that ran the Association of Graduates and whatnot took over as the superintendent. But Bowman was the superintendent in 1863.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Go see Brian in the back of the room. And we'll see you in June. Everybody drive safely.
I got your package.
Yeah, we're gonna put it back in the.